Hello and a very warm welcome to Section D, Monocle 24's dedicated design show. I'm Henry Rhys Sheridan.
And I'm Josh Fennett. On today's show, we book in some time with the writers, commissioners, printers and editors behind the design world's budding publishing scene.
Designers are still wedded to print, particularly if they spend all day designing websites and apps. They want to get their hands on something physical.
We'll find out how in the supposedly torrid times for print, and despite the prevalence of backlit screens, that there's still a market for well-bound books to do with design.
We find out about a UK-based imprint, Unit Editions, from co-founder Adrian Shaughnessy, and take a tour of Melbourne with an independent publisher set on preserving the city's architectural legacy, all before speaking to Lars Müller about his eponymous publishing house in Zurich.
Plus, I visit a printing press in London's Bethnal Green to get a maker's perspective on the state of print today. All that coming up right here on Section D on Monocle 24. First up on today's show, we consider the opportunities and headaches inherent in setting up an imprint.
It won't have escaped the attention of regular Monocle readers that we've got a soft spot for the well-bound delights of Unit Editions, a South London-based publisher whose work ranges from monographs to manuals, which chart the course of graphic design and visual culture today.
We sat down with designer, writer and editor Adrian Shaughnessy, the co-founder of the company, to find out what motivated him to start the firm and why an online sales model can benefit businesses bent on committing their ideas to paper.
It came out of a frustration that I had with conventional publishers, particularly publishers producing design books. And I just felt they didn't really understand designers, and working with them was slow, painful, and really just not what I wanted to do. So in partnership with a wonderful designer called Tony Brook, who'd already dabbled in publishing, he'd produced some very small-scale publications, he and I put our heads together and said, look, why can't we do this? Because I was interested in writing and editing. His interest is entirely in the visual realm. And it seemed like a kind of perfect partnership. And we started, I think we're into our sixth year now. It really came out of a frustration with not being able to get the design books that we personally wanted. So we'd only ever publish something that we were personally committed to. And a frustration with the traditional book publishing world, which, as most people know, is slow, cumbersome, and really sort of lost its way, I think, in many respects. Not all, but in some respects lost its way.
And you've gone on to prove your point rather emphatically by making such beautiful books. But take me back to 2010. How does a writer, an editor, and a graphic designer go about learning the book trade? Was it a simple transition? Well, met the publishers and they did everything?
It was a transition, but it wasn't simple. We produced our first book, which was a book called Studio Culture. And that was a book that we realized that no one had ever done a book on the design studio. Actually, how do you set one up? So we thought, right, let's do a book on studio culture. And we went through the traditional book trade. We had it distributed with lots of very helpful people. And it nearly killed us because you have to supply the title months in advance. You wait another to get any money back. And usually you get more returns than you get money. So we just knew we couldn't survive. We would need huge amounts of investment to do that. So we turned to the obvious alternative, the internet. And it's paradoxical what success we've had has come through the internet. So we only sell our books online and in a handful around the world of specialist shops. And we deal with them direct. There's no distributors. So we learned the hard way. We learned that we could not survive without very, very deep pockets in the traditional world. But by selling online to graphic designers, using social media to get to them, we found we had an audience and a market.
And it's interesting that the internet obviously allows you to sell without having a bricks and mortar space. It's a very simple way that where you have a good product, you can show it off, you can send it straight to people. But I wonder if you think print is in any way imperiled by the backlit screens through which we consume information.
There is a massive issue, and we know this, although oddly, I think something's happening. And this came to me in 2 days a week. I teach at the RCA, and I'm working with a PhD student at the moment who's looking at this question of the actual biological difference between reading on the backlit screen and reading on the paper. And there's some research in America which says if you're going to read textbooks, if you're going to read material that you want to retain, you have to read it on paper. It actually sinks in better, which is really interesting. But I also think designers, which is our audience, I think designers are still wedded to print, particularly if they spend all day designing websites and apps. They want to get their hands on something physical. So I think, weirdly, I think e-books, and there's some evidence too in terms of sales, that the e-book sales are falling off and that the printed specimen is rising. I think it's slightly different in newspapers and magazines. I think there's a much tougher battle there. But I think books have won through. They've survived in the way that perhaps, physical music didn't.
I agree, and you're preaching to the converted in terms of the importance of the tactility of print, and also Monocle magazine. Obviously, we've talked a lot about how people consume information, so that research is very valid, and I suppose it's heartening to know that these books won't just become the preserve of graphic designers and people involved in kind of visual culture, but I'm intrigued by the other purpose of some of your books. So you've launched the Archive series recently, and I'm intrigued about how a book can be a piece of preservation as well as a piece of beautiful information. Can you tell us how you're using print in this way?
One of the things that we absolutely need to do these sorts of books, we need access to archives. And I think, interestingly, graphic design has only woken up to the archive in the last, I would say, few decades. And people are now actually collecting this stuff. But of course, it just sits in dusty old archives. So our feeling is that if we can get access to this stuff, we can democratize it, we can disseminate it, we can make it public. So it's a case of, I also think it ties in with another interesting that, just like I think there's a revival of interest in the physical book, weirdly in design, there's an interest in design history. And that didn't exist, personally, I wasn't even interested myself 10 years ago. But there seems to be something in about the great figures that have gone before and looking at them and seeing what we can learn. So I think it's a kind of way of celebrating the past and opening up archives, because archives can be pretty sort of uninviting places.
Adrian Shaughnessy, designer, writer, editor and co-founder of UK publisher Unit Editions there. We implore any book aficionados to visit their website, unitditions.com, for more information and a few nice books.
Melbourne's bustling central business district is a popular destination for tourists. Too often, though, out-of-towners who visit can forget to do one important thing: appreciate the city's eclectic architectural bounty.
But not local filmmaker Jacques Sherd. 1 year ago, Jacques and a couple of good friends decided to self-publish a set of books that explained the history of Melbourne's most beautiful buildings. The group entitled the series Footpath Guides, a bright-hued, small-format collection that quickly became a hit.
They're beautifully designed and feature expertly rendered illustrations by local graphic designer Sonia Post. Every copy also comes with a handy map which guides readers through an architectural walking tour of the city.
To get an idea of what makes these tours so special, the intrepid Adrian Craddock, our man in Melbourne, recently met Jacques to explore the route and to learn more about the city's mid-century architecture.
The lunch hour rush is just starting when I meet Jacques Sherd in central Melbourne. Businessmen are pouring out of the surrounding buildings and onto the pavement, their eyes glued to their phones. I greet Jacques and we start weaving through the crowd. Before long, he pulls out a small blue book from his pocket. It's the mid-century edition of Footpath Guides, one of three books that he has researched and written about Melbourne's architecture. On the back page is a fold-out map marked with dotted lines and numbers. It's a walking tour that's designed to help readers experience the beauty of Melbourne's buildings firsthand. Jacques gestures towards a point in the middle of the map, and together we start moving towards a tall building in the distance. It's a structure that I'd never particularly noticed before, a concrete behemoth that looks vaguely Japanese in influence. As we get closer, Jacques flicks through his book, stops at a page around halfway through, and starts explaining what we're looking at.
We are at the Hoyt Cinema Centre, which was designed in and built in 1969 by Peter Muller. So this building, if you look at its form, it's like an inverted pagoda.
Around us, there are people kind of walking around on their lunch breaks and no one seems to be really looking up. Is it fair to say that a lot of people in this city kind of overlook some of these great architectural gems?
I think that's true in any city, any urban environment. I think most people, especially if you work in a place day to day, you don't look up every time you step out on the street. Part of the reason is with these guys to encourage people to stop, look up and look around.
And is that happening with the guides? I mean, they're distributed all throughout the city. Have you got some pretty good feedback?
We have, yeah. I think there is a growing interest in modernist post-war architecture, especially with younger people.
All right, well, let's move on to the next building on the walk then.
Sure.
A large amount of the buildings in the mid-century footpath guide are similar to the Hoyt Cinema Centre in size. Jacques has an obvious affection for explaining the stories behind huge skyscrapers. But there are more modest structures in the book too. Our next stop, which is one of Jacques' favourite buildings, is a good example.
This is actually a bit of a Melbourne institution. Pellegrini's Espresso Bar. It was established in 1954, and legend has it that they had the first espresso machine in Melbourne. Now, that's disputed by a couple of other establishments, but it's good enough for us. We wanted to include it because it's pretty much untouched from when it was built, so it really is a throwback to that 1950s, 1960s era, which is, you know, pretty much what the entire mid-century book is about.
So with these books, is there an intention to incite a feeling of preservation within the city? I mean, do you want kind of councillors to look at this and maybe think twice about how they develop some of these buildings that in your eyes do have a lot of value?
Definitely. That's one of the reasons we decided to do them, because a lot of these buildings, especially the mid-century book, a lot of post-war buildings are being knocked down or redeveloped or having their facades completely altered.
So would you almost call the guides examples of activism?
In a way, yeah, probably. More controversially, again, the mid-century book, we do sort of push the brutalism aspect. And so, yeah, we'd like to sort of get more notice put on those buildings and get more attention drawn to buildings that, even if you may consider them ugly and not particularly pretty buildings, some of them still deserve to be kept.
When you were cultivating this idea, why did you choose to make it into a print product? I mean, was there ever a time when you thought, oh, this would be perfectly fine on a blog or an app or something like that?
No, from the beginning, it was always going to be a hard copy book. I don't know, it's just the aesthetic of it, it's the tactile nature of it, you know, having a book, opening up, making notes, something that you can take home after, you know, visiting a country, for example, and you know that's been with you throughout the different places you've gone sightseeing. It's got, you know, it's wrinkled, it's a bit torn, it's, you know, maybe got a stain of a coffee you had that morning. You know, it's got memories in it that you just can't find with online content.
Why did you decide on the format of a walking tour?
I think it's the best way to discover a city. I've done a fair bit of travelling and I love nothing more than, as soon as I've landed in a place, settled into the hotel, just go out the front door and walk. You know, don't catch a taxi, don't get a train, don't get a bus, just walk. It's the only way you really get to know a place. And it's the best way to view the architecture at your own pace.
So maybe let's just go to one last stop on the map. Where do you want to go next?
Yeah, I'd like to finish on it with a very significant building in Melbourne. It's ICI House.
Along the way towards the final stop of our tour, we pass a handful of independent bookstores and gift shops that stock footpath guides. Jacques explains that managing distribution has been one of the most challenging parts of putting out the books. He says that David Roper, a businessman who also helped produce footpath guides, spends a lot of time hand-delivering books to stockists. He says it's hard work, but it's paid off. As we move towards the front of a large glass building, Jacques tells me that the guides are selling well, and there's a plan to release similar books for Sydney. All right, so we're just at our final stop here. What do we have in front of us?
We have what was once Australia's tallest building, and when completed in 1958, the former ICI House.
It doesn't really look that tall, to be honest.
For a long time, Melbourne had a building height limit of 132 feet, and that was broken by this building, basically. It was huge. People brought their families into the city to look at the building, basically. That's how spectacular it was.
Is it quite nerve-wracking as someone who's self-published to get the facts right for something like this? Because there's a lot of different dates and figures that go along with these buildings. And usually within a larger publishing house, you'd have the luxury of someone looking over your shoulder. How did you go about that?
That's one thing that I do worry about, because you want to get it right, because there are a lot of people that know a lot more than I do about these buildings. And, you know, I'm the first to admit that. I'm not an academic by any means, but I strove hard to get the facts, you know, cross-checking two or three different resources. Hopefully we've got everything right. There's probably a couple of mistakes here and there, and I'm sure there are, but we really tried to get as close to the truth as possible.
Was there any talk of getting a major publisher involved? Why did you choose to do it yourself?
Primarily because we want to maintain creative control. We knew how we wanted the book to look. We knew the audience we wanted to be targeting. We knew the format. We knew exactly what we wanted. And if you start dealing with publishers, you know, you start sort of forfeiting a lot of those creative decisions. and you end up with something that you may not really be happy with.
And is it a lot of kind of late nights and stressful poring over proofs and stuff like that?
No, there's really no stress to it. We really enjoy it. I've found that it's almost like a hobby. It's something you do because you enjoy doing it. We don't feel stressed or, you know, there's no anxiety about when they even, you know, we like to get them out as soon as possible. But I enjoy researching the buildings. I enjoy writing about the buildings. Everything is quite enjoyable. I can't really think of a moment where we've been stressed at all.
So what do you hope people come away feeling after they've picked up one of these books?
I hope they come away with obviously a better understanding of Melbourne's built environment and subsequently other cities that we plan to write about. We're pretty lucky to have such a diverse range of architecture here.
Our Melbourne correspondent Adrian Craddock on Jacques Sherd's charming footpath travel guides.
Still to come on the show, we zigzag to Zurich for a few words with designer and publisher extraordinaire Lars Müller.
Plus, we visit a London-based printing press to learn a little more about the business of bookbinding and the craft of creating a book.
Dubbed the New Berlin, Leipzig is now home to a dynamic cluster of artist studios and galleries. Monocle Films tour the ateliers of Spinnerei, a former cotton mill and now home to the city's emerging art scene.
For working, it's really brilliant here. It has such a good atmosphere, such a positive atmosphere. And when I come in, I go through this little corridor and then I lock the door. And this is like an own space. The time seems to run different.
Leipzig, Art City, now playing in the film section at monocle.com.
The debate around the state of book publishing frequently focuses on the imprint and the name on the spine, missing out a crucial link in the production process, the printers themselves.
There's still a craft and a business in printing paper-bound books, though. To find out more, I paid a visit to Calvert, an independent printing press based in East London's Bethnal Green. The firm publishes books for established architects and up-and-comers alike, in a remarkable array of trims and materials. Here's our impression of this busy publishing house.
My name's David, I'm the machine minder at Calvert's. We've just made ready and we're just about to run 1,000 sheets of sticker paper in four colour.
My name is Sean Wellens. I am a project manager and client relationship manager for Calvert's. We're graphic designers and printers. We print high-end books and brochure work. And I've worked with Calvert's for 33 years. I started here as a printer. Over the years, we've worked with lots and lots of very, very small and very large practices. So one and two person, you know, up-and-coming practices. In Germany, we've worked with Richard Rogers, we've worked with Field & Clegg Bradley, we still work with Field & Clegg Bradley, so right across the piece, 00 architects. And I think it's really word of mouth, it's the fact that we've been working in this area for so long, for, you know, nearly 40 years, that people just hear about us, find out about us. Obviously, we do market ourselves, we have our website, we put the word out. But because we're designers and we're doing all sorts of, our graphic design is all, it's all 2D. We do exhibition work, we design film titles, we do branding and identity. But actually our core discipline is print and always has been. So we're able to bring an enormous amount of print knowledge to our design work and a lot of design knowledge to our print clients who perhaps don't understand or know what's possible in terms of materials and formats and paper and so on and so forth. So we're able to spend a lot of time with artists and designers and architects showing them examples of what's been done, what can be done, and then that takes it through to a specification and we can produce it for them.
Who is ordering from you and what are they ordering and how has that changed since you've been in the industry?
Well, I've been in it for quite a long time, but you could say, you know, when I started as a printer at Calvert's, we were printing very long runs, you know, 100,000, 150,000 leaflets. So, you know, we were working for arts organisations, we were working for political organisations like the anti-apartheid movement and Campaign for Nuclear Disarmament and the ecology movement, as it was called in those days. And the way you got information out, you know, mass information out, was to print.
What we find now is that, one, the print runs are much, much smaller, so the typical print run will be under 500, and very often now we're doing short digital runs of 20, 25 books. We're doing it for art students, we're doing it for presentations, we're doing edition books for architects, designers, and generally the quality requirements has gone up. So what's happened is that print has become a sort of a niche specialist product, where people are looking for something that's very high impact, because a book costs quite a lot of money to make. So it's how people use books with other media to promote ideas or to promote an agenda or to promote a manifesto. There are fewer printers in London now, so I think we may be the only large offset format litho printer in central London. When I came to London, there were hundreds of us. Clerkenwell was printing workshops end to end. A lot of what I would call commodity print isn't done in London anymore, so it's one of these traditional London industries that is no longer a London industry. It's gone out to South Wales, but a lot of print is done in countries that still have a very large industrial base in print, like Italy, which has very high level of technical education in print and has therefore managed to keep its industry. There was a period when there was a lot of work going to China. There is still a lot of work goes to China, but actually less than there used to be, because it's more expensive now and it takes longer to get it back from China. Technological innovation has been incredible. So making a set of printing plates for a book now might take a skilled person on our platforms a few minutes to impose a designer's files, to create a large TIFF file to image a printing plate. So basically, to create a set of full-color printing plates for a litho book, the sort of productivity level, the amount of work that goes into it, is probably a hundredth of what it was 20 years ago, when it was all done manually with film separations and high-skilled mask cutting and that type of thing. So our productivity is enormous, but we're using this to actually do incredibly bespoke stuff, and that seems to be what's changed.
And finally, are you optimistic, pessimistic, or somewhere in between with regards to the future of printing presses in places like London?
I'm somewhere in between. The market for print is becoming more and more niche, but there is a whole revival of print movement going on. And it actually largely comes out of the design schools and the art schools, because students are becoming more interested in what I would call authenticity. Also, there's the whole maker movement, which is essentially artisan production using high technologies like 3D printing and so forth. So we're sort of involved in that whole area, and that's very interesting and has possibilities. But I fear for industries like printing in London, because printing is a space-hungry, you know, and it's not a high value added on the whole in terms of the wider market. So it's very difficult for people to put together a commercial enterprise doing print in the places that are the homelands of design and architecture and making, which is, you know, East London. So we, for instance, we're renting here. We've got a 10-year lease. We're in the second half of a 10-year lease. We've never spent money on buildings. We've never bought a building, because we always said, if we've got money, what we want to do is to invest it in better and better technology so that we can do better and better stuff, not in buildings. But eventually you get caught out by that, because rents double and triple. So we'll see. It may be that we'll see a commercial property crash in London in the next few years, and industries like furniture making and design and printing can come back into the metropolis. But we still hope to be here in quite a few years' time.
That was Sean Wellens, product manager at Calvert's Printing Press in London's Bethnal Green.
Finally, on this week's show, we speak to a doyen of the design and architecture publishing scene.
Lars Müller is a Norwegian-born designer who has been based in Switzerland since 1963. It's here that, shortly after establishing his own studio, he turned his hand to well-bound books.
Fast forward to the present day, and Lars Müller Publishers is behind a library of 600 books on architecture, design, photography, contemporary art and society. We caught up with the luminary to discuss the shifting dynamics of the art and architecture publishing world. He joined us on the line from Zurich.
Lars, you produce some of the finest design and architecture books out there, both in terms of content and materials, and continue to do so in very challenging times for the publishing industry. Why do you think people are willing to invest in large, expensive books on design and architecture when so many architecture and design resources are available online?
Well, it's not about large books necessarily, but it's about a division of content which may belong into one or the other media. And I believe if, as I try and other publishers do, if we make a sharp and engaged division of content which we believe, you know, has a value to be collected and maybe even perceived in the form of a linear reading and the real-time experience of reading a book, but then end up in your library and become kind of collective memory accessible later and at any time by anybody. That seems to be a good reason to me.
Lars, how do you decide what books to publish? And could you describe the process of how a book goes from conception to someone's bookshelf or coffee table?
For my self-defense, I always try to point to the fact that Lars Mill Publishers is a small, very small practice. So amongst the 25 to 30 books we publish a year, most of them have a relation to my personal interests. So I must be affected by the content of the book or taken, and or I initiate books myself. I bring up a topic and I search for partners who I can develop the content further. So it's very much related to my personal curiosity.
Lars, who's buying your books? So where are the biggest markets? Where do you think the most exciting emerging markets are? And who do you want to buy your books?
Well, geographically, Europe is still strong, while the North America is our strongest and biggest market. Asia is growing. We sell quite many licenses to China at the moment. So I would say that I try to consolidate the European and the North American market while reaching out for Latin America and Asia more. If I don't sound too naive, but I would hope for a younger audience than an older, knowing that people between 40 and 60 may spend most money on books, while younger people either don't have the money or they don't see the money value in books yet. I would say that an audience between 25 and 40, I think, is the most relevant for the content and content decisions I take. And I believe they will come back, or they do come back to the book, and they also appreciate the book as an object and the design and so forth. Why this group of people? Well, with the age of 25, you may enter a phase of your life where you may have your first salary, and but you are in a situation where you have to take decisions on your career and select content somehow. And at the age of 40, you enter a phase where you are a decision maker, even in social terms and society. You may have understood that you are not only an architect, but also a citizen. Of course, I'm happy whoever buys a book, but it's certainly more significant if the buyer, the person, the reader, is in an active phase of his life.
That was designer and publisher Lars Müller speaking to us about his eponymous imprint in Zurich.
And sadly, that's all we have time for on this week's show. My very special thanks to our ever-patient editor, Alex Funnell, Chris Grimes behind the glass, and the show's producer, sat opposite me, twinkly-eyed as usual, Henry Rhys Sheridan.
If you have any comments or queries, then feel free to drop me a note. I'm at hrs@monocle.com. Remember, we're back next week at the same time, and you can always listen again or dip into our back catalogue at monocle.com, SoundCloud, and iTunes. If you happen to visit us on the latter, please leave a review.
You've been listening to Section D. I'm Josh Fennett.
And I'm Henry Rhys Sheridan. Until next time, it's goodbye from us, and thanks for listening.